with Custodians of the Planet. Custodians of the Planet brings consciousness to environmental issues and looks at different perspectives regarding the tensions and harmony of human activities in a changing climate. Keeping people safe is one of the core functions of governments. Unfortunately, due to lack of action on climate change, no action on climate change, and even actions fueling climate change, governments are failing to uphold this core function, not only for us alive in the here and now, but for future generations to come. It's a tough job to effectively communicate to governments the truth and scale of this existential threat. It is essential that people stand up, speak out, hold our governments accountable, find ways to unite people, ignite people, and create change. Extinction Rebellion is a group that is taking this job head on. Briefly, XR is an environmental protest group and a global movement that is forcing climate and environmental issues into media. They are a non-violent protest group which occupy public spaces, displaying large banners, and interrupting daily life events to a certain extent. It declares itself as an international non-violent rebellion against the world's governments for criminal action on the ecological crisis. Today, Holly Champion, who is a member of Extinction Rebellion Sydney, joins us. Holly, welcome to Custodians of the Planet.
Hi, thanks, Anise.
Tell me about Extinction Rebellion in Australia. What are the demands of Extinction Rebellion?
Okay, so we've taken our lead from the UK Extinction Rebellion movement, who founded it last year in about May and came to global prominence beginning from November last year. So our three demands are, first of all, that the government and media must tell the truth about how deadly our situation is and reverse all communications that are not in line with that. Secondly, that our government commits to carbon drawdown and anti-emission policies to reach net zero by 2025. Now, this has been criticised as an unreasonably short time frame to do this in. And, you know, maybe it is, but the reality is that if we are to obey any kind of precautionary principle in our massive experiment that we're running with the environment, we need to achieve net zero emissions as absolutely as soon as possible. And to be honest, I wonder whether this would be possible, but I think that given the kind of mobilisation of the workforce and the economy and government that we saw during World War II, I think if we take that kind of mentality, policies align with that, it would actually be possible to achieve something like net zero emissions by 2025 or shortly after. But basically, that very ambitious time frame sends a very strong message that, you know, even if we don't achieve that, we've got to commit to trying to achieve something like that time frame because we are literally out of time. We are in debt. We no longer have any more carbon to put into the atmosphere. We have to start not only stopping our emissions, but also actually actively taking the carbon out of the environment, out of the atmosphere that we've already put in through massive rewilding and reforesting programs mainly. Our third demand is quite interesting. It is that we demand a participatory democracy. We demand a citizens' assembly installed in our government and political processes that will oversee the changes to watch this take place and to ensure that this takes place, because what we've seen up till now is that our government is failing quite dramatically to act on climate change, particularly the Australian government here. We're at the front line of climate change environmentally. Our country is already overstretched its ecological limits, and we are going to see massive droughts. We're going to see massive food shortages. We're going to see compounding, cascading effects of droughts and hurricanes, cyclones, seawater rises, other types of storm surges and floods, and all these disasters just compound one on top of the other to already vulnerable parts of our landscape and our communities. So our government has basically failed us, so we don't trust them anymore, which is why we want participatory democracy, where the people actually have a voice in the policies that are being put forward.
Tell me about yourself. What do you do and what's your role in Extinction Rebellion?
So my background is in arts and academia. My PhD was in opera performance analysis right here at UNSW, where we're recording today. And recently, in recent years, since I finished my PhD, I've been working variously in arts administration, piano teaching, and other music teaching, and also in directing. I've directed a couple of operatic or musical productions. Writing, I've written a few scripts, and I do a lot of reviews of performances, mainly operas, and also acting and piano performance. So I am currently external arts coordinator for Extinction Rebellion in New South Wales, which means that I have to liaise with the other external coordinators from each working group to work out how our strategy aligns. So we're all helping each other instead of working against each other in our movement.
Is it international in Australia, or is it?
We do have some links to XR International, but mostly we're operating as a pretty autonomous group within New South Wales. And gradually that's moving to, as we're proliferating, our groups are proliferating. We've got one up in the Blue Mountains now, got a very strong one going on the Central Coast, one developing up in Lismore, and one developing down in Wollongong. So it's getting to the point now where I don't need to be arts coordinator for New South Wales anymore. I can just be external arts coordinator for Sydney, or even eventually just for the eastern suburbs maybe. So it's really, and we've experienced massive growth over the past 6 months, which is really exciting. So within the arts working group, what our job is to do is basically to provide performances, to provide beautiful graphics, posters, t-shirts, caps, like merchandise. We can't make any profit on the Extinction Rebellion symbol, but we have had a whole bunch of t-shirts recently made up, which everyone's wearing. It's really exciting to see them. We've got some interesting performances in the works. We've got some Red Rebels, which is a contingent of performers who, it started in England again. So we're all dressed in red, these kind of toga type robe kind of outfits with white faces. And we perform different emotions as a silent troupe. So that's going to be my first appearance at one of our protests coming up. We've got a choir starting now within the Sydney area, and we'll be joining forces with the Blue Mountains Choir, which is also starting up. So lots of stuff going on and in the arts working group, and it's very exciting.
Yeah, sounds really exciting. It seems Extinction Rebellion has a creative, rebellious spirit. And I think it needs to be creative because it's a non-violent activism, right? What is nonviolence activism in practice?
One of our core principles is that we're nonviolent, and that extends to every aspect of our functioning, including our in-meeting communication. Commit to not using violent language. But sort of most fundamentally, that means that we are following the principles that were founded by Roger Hallam, Gail Bradbrook, and a number of other people who founded Extinction Rebellion, a lot of whom were academics as well as activists. And they had read some research by Erica Chenoweth, who is a US researcher in protest movements. And she had done a review of protest movements for about the last 150 years. And she had determined that the nonviolent movements were more successful because they engaged a larger percentage of the population. They didn't just rely on young, fit, angry young men to create lots of damage. They tended to not annoy people and anger people so much and make them fearful. So the people, like the general population, were much more open to accepting and hearing what the protest movement was saying. They tended to not get as much pushback from the government. And because they're engaging a much greater percentage of the population, Erica Chenoweth found that if you have a nonviolent movement that engages more than 3.5% of the population in any given region or country, over the past 150 years or so, that has never failed to enact positive change or change that has been desired by the protest movement. So that is really encouraging. So what our major mission is with Extinction Rebellion is that we want to engage hopefully 3.5% or more of the Australian population and the population worldwide to get them on board with facing up to climate truth and pushing for our demands to be met.
Do you know the number right now?
No, I don't know actually. Within New South Wales, we've got about 5,000 people who seem to be actively involved at the moment, with a few more thousand who are kind of passively involved. But I don't know the numbers for XR nationally. Mm. It was really encouraging to see at the last global strike for climate, which the school kids have been spearheading. They're Fridays for Future school kids. There were over, I think, 1.3 million people protesting worldwide. And some of the biggest numbers were in Australia, including about 30,000 protesting in Sydney. So we've been partnering with them more and more as we go along, and we realise that, you know, a lot of our goals align. They have slightly different time frame. They want to see net zero carbon emissions by 2030 rather than 2025. But, you know, in general, our goals align pretty ambitious. Well with this. Yeah.
Can you give a few examples for nonviolent activism?
So we've taken a bit of inspiration from the civil rights movement in the 1960s. There was a group, I think they were in 1961, who deliberately aimed to be arrested. And I'm not very familiar with all their practices, but basically the idea is that we engage in nonviolent actions such as sitting down, disrupting the flow of traffic, or gluing ourselves to buildings, or pouring blood down, fake blood down steps, for example, that attract media attention and can lead to mass arrests. So the mass arrest aspect is one of the core features of Extinction Rebellion's ethos. Not everyone who's involved in Extinction Rebellion needs to be arrested. A lot of people can't be arrested for whatever reason. You know, they've got childcare responsibilities, or their career won't be able to withstand that kind of issue. But a lot of people can be arrested for a very low level kind of criminal offence. Usually you wouldn't get jail time for any of the offences that we're perpetrating. They're very mild, but they're deliberately designed to attract attention from the media and attract attention by government and by the general public. So they're not designed to destroy property. We deliberately engage in actions that we can clean up after. Mm-hmm. They're designed to disrupt the idea that business as usual can continue.
And what if there is an emergency, like an ambulance or like a fire service while you're protesting? Did this happen before?
I haven't specifically been involved in a case like this, but there was a case in London last November where they were blocking bridges and they were allowing all emergency vehicles through, okay, but no other vehicles.
So it's kind of a peaceful disobedience.
Yeah, it's non-violent civil disobedience, basically. It's not really criminal. Yeah. You know, sometimes it can be considered criminal actions, but in general, it's designed to get attention and to disrupt rather than to destroy or specifically to make people angry.
Mm-hmm. I think I actually found out Extinction Rebellion through a die-in protest. And I was wondering, how do people react to this protest? What do they do?
Basically, when we all suddenly pretend to die, it does attract a lot of attention from people walking past, and it makes some really great photo ops, which is great for media coverage. It tends to startle people because they don't expect it. I guess we'll probably have to start shifting to some other actions fairly soon because people are starting to expect it now from us. So we have to keep adjusting our tactics to keep that element of surprise and interest and disruption.
Mm. It requires creativity for sure.
Yeah, well, that's what the Arts Working Group's designed to do. inject a little bit of creativity into all our protests and our actions.
Mm. In July, Swiss police detained dozens of climate protesters. Recently, police used pepper spray on seated climate protesters in Paris. Same in Germany, the arrests came. Why peaceful protests lead to arrests?
Well, we're honestly going up against some of the most deeply embedded and powerful people and power structures in our global economies and our global systems of governance. As Greenpeace found out quite recently, there was an interesting video that they put out. The coal and fossil fuels industry, they basically have a revolving door of positions between government, actual politicians, positions of government, and positions of advisors to government and public policy positions and lobbying positions and high positions within those industries and those corporations. These people just keep moving around and around, and they get a lot of money wherever they go. So it's in their best interests to resist our kind of movement because we are trying to shut down their industry, basically. So I have to say that I think there's probably corruption going on at a large scale within our governments, but I personally don't have actual evidence for that. But I really recommend watching that Greenpeace video about the stranglehold that fossil fuel corporations have on our government processes and our politicians. Mm. So recently in 2016, the New South Wales government passed legislation to make it a stronger offence, criminal offence, to interfere with a mine that carries now a penalty of up to 7 years in jail. So that's a far harsher sentence and possible penalty than pretty much any other type of non-violent protesting in certainly in Australia, which suggests that, unfortunately, our government is willing to restrict our ability to protest and our civil right, which is basically a fundamental right to protest. So I'm hoping that that's not the thin end of the wedge. Well, it's quite a thick end of the wedge, really. It's quite significant. I'm hoping that our government doesn't move to increase penalties continuously for protesters, because obviously it makes our jobs harder. We won't stop, but it makes it harder.
Do these events, arrests and the penalties you mentioned, create fear for you?
Yeah, especially finding out that is possible, that you can spend up to 7 years in jail just for protesting, for example, stopping a train that's going into a mine to get coal. You know, like, it's disruptive, but it's not something that I would have thought warrants a 7-year jail term. Maybe a fine, you know. So that does create a bit of fear for me, but to be honest, I have much greater fear around the long-term impacts of climate change. Much, much greater fear.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting concepts is the perceived risk by humans, because I think the study was in US. Yeah, I'm not sure. But anyway, so basically, according to this study, the perceived risk of flooding is much greater than the climate change. And it seems it's pretty much the same for Australia. The results of Australia's recent federal election tell us something about how most Australians, or as Scott Morrison likes to call them, the quiet Australians, are feeling in regards to climate change. There is clearly a gap to bridge. What do you think is the best way to bring those people into the conversation?
This is very interesting, because I think it was quite clear from the polling that climate change was up there. It was probably number one issue on people's minds going into the election. But there is a large proportion of the population that are really feeling the economic squeeze at the moment. Real wages are really quite low at the moment, and they haven't risen for quite some time. And there are a lot of communities that are basically bound to the fossil fuel industries, because our government has continuously invested in fossil fuels, in mining, and not invested in renewable energies. The jobs don't yet exist in large enough numbers and in those communities that are feeling so deprived, dispossessed and frightened, basically, of how these, you know, there are a lot of people who are worried how they're going to pay their mortgage, how they're going to feed their kids, you know, in the short term. We're asking them to consider very, very long-term impacts, largely. I mean, some of them are short-term, you know, we're already seeing the impacts of climate change in our country, and certainly in more rural areas it's felt more strongly with the drought that's been going on in New South Wales especially. But a lot of what the science tells us is quite long-term. So we're asking people who have really urgent issues to address to prioritise the long-term over the urgent, and that's not something that the human brain is wired to do. So I think, as well as putting investment into developing renewable energies, technologies and industries in these sometimes quite impoverished communities to create more jobs in a sustainable sector, we also need to really understand where people who voted for the coalition are coming from and voted for coal mining come from. And I think a big part of that is listening. I think that activists need to listen more, and we tend to talk a lot, as I'm doing right now, and not listen as much as maybe we should. And we also need to be very kind and understanding in how we approach people who are not yet at the point where they want to accept the full reality of climate science and what it's telling us, because it is incredibly difficult information to process psychologically and emotionally. Where the science is now is basically telling us that if we don't change our ways very, very soon and very, very radically, we are facing, within the next, you know, 50 or so years, we're facing probable breakdown of our international civil order, mass famine, you know, mass migration, really, really bad stuff, which a lot of people really just don't want to think about. And that's completely understandable. So I think it's we need to be more open, we need to listen more, and we need to be kinder in how we talk to people. Because if someone's starting to accept the science, the last thing that they need is to be shamed for their previous beliefs. The last thing that they need to be is to be shamed for their actions. There's a lot of guilt that comes up when you start to accept the truth of what's going on. And I've felt it myself. You know, how could I have spent the last 10 years going on overseas holidays, flying everywhere? How could I have spent, you know, so many years of my life working in an industry that has probably actually no future if it's linked to the fossil fuel industries? How can I have, you know, given birth to my children and be planning for a future for them only to realise, when I could have known earlier, that they maybe don't have a very good future at all? There's a lot of guilt that comes up. So I think that part of what we need to do is just to be very gentle with people who are making that transition, because it's a very difficult emotional journey.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a lot to take in, hey. And I think our first defense mechanism is just avoiding or pretending as if it's not happening. But climate grief is a real thing. And I think there will be another episode about climate grief. I think we all need emotional support these days. So my another question is, what makes people support action on climate breakdown, and what ignites the fire inside people and gets them out there of their houses?
So Dr. Margaret Klein-Salomon in the US, who's a leading climate change psychologist, climate anxiety, eco-anxiety, climate grief, and a lead campaigner on the climate emergency movement. She has done a lot of research into what it means to go into emergency mode. So emergency mode serves a very useful psychological function in humans. When we see that there is a problem that is very, very urgent and very serious, we can flip over into this different way of functioning where pretty much all of our resources, all of our attention is devoted to sorting out this problem first before we get back to living our normal life, which is where we have a diverse kind of portfolio of priorities and areas of our life that we want to maintain and attend to. If we're in emergency mode, that is put aside for the time being until the emergency is sorted out. And you can see this in operation when someone's house is on fire, for example, which is the simile that Greta Thunberg used. When someone's house is on fire, you don't sit there going, oh, you know, what should we put out first? Or maybe we should have changed that extra side of the house so it's not so vulnerable to fire. Or maybe we should think about rebuilding. Or, you know, you don't think about those things. You think, how can I get myself and my children out of the house? How can I get some of my most valued possessions out of the house safely? And then once everyone's safe, how do we put the fire out? So our first order of priority is to flip into emergency mode. And that happens when people see other people going into emergency mode. It doesn't usually happen for most people. It doesn't usually happen by reading information. It happens when they see another person taking action. You don't start usually putting out a small fire because you've seen a fire. Usually, for most people, they start putting out that fire because they see someone else running to get a bucket. So that's what I and a lot of Extinction Rebellion people are trying to do, is to be the change that we want to see. You know, model that for other people who are sort of sitting on the fence, or maybe they're apathetic. They think, oh, well, I don't really need to do anything because the government's going to sort it out. The IPCC report will wake everyone up. You know, it's not my responsibility. Which is what a lot of people think. And it's what I thought up until October last year when the IPCC report came out.
I love when you said be the change that you want to see. Moving on, because there are still many things that I want to find out about XR. Action can be analyzed by its legality and its morality. What is the difference between the legality and the morality of XR's actions?
So our systems of ethics and morality are basically, when you think about them, they're basically founded on what is good for the group, what is going to promote our social well-being, our social survival, even if that means going against your own selfish interests. That's pretty much what all our human morality is founded on. Some of it, you know, you've got extra elements like what's founded on disgust, unnatural human disgust reactions and things like that. But I'd say that that's the primary one, is what is good for the group. So if you've got a government that is continually enacting laws and policies that are not good for the group, not good for our society as a whole, then it becomes a moral imperative to act against those and to protest or to actively disobey those laws and those policies.
And lastly, what has been missing in this battle?
Our first demand as Extinction Rebellion is that the media tell the truth. So I think a big part of what has been missing in this battle is that the media has not been telling the truth. And the media, for better or worse, dictate a lot of our civil discourse, our public conversation. And they have either willfully or just because they haven't realised the magnitude of the crisis, they have disregarded the most important story of our time. Probably the most important issue of our collective lifetimes. And that is a kind of shocking error on the part of journalism. You know, they're supposed to focus on the big stories. But instead, they have generally been distracting us. And I can't help but feel that in some cases that has been a deliberate attempt to pacify the population into inaction on climate change.
Yeah, those media organizations also run by people.
Exactly. Yeah. Media organizations are run by people like Rupert Murdoch, who often have quite a lot of interest in maintaining the status quo, maintaining their investments in fossil fuel industries, etc. So because of that, because they have been so extraordinarily reticent about discussing the key issue of our lifetimes, there has been a real public unwillingness to face up to the truth. It hasn't been shoved in our faces enough for us to ignore it. And there is a very, very natural human desire to want to ignore this because it is nasty. It is not fun to think about. Mm. It's not fun to talk about. I can shut down a dinner party in about 5 minutes. You know, it's not socially acceptable to talk about how bad the situation is.
True.
So there, yeah, is a lack of widespread kind of emotional, psychological support from our psychologists, from our teachers in schools, from, you know, parents with their children, and sort of in our civil discourse. There's a lack of widespread emotional support for the difficulty of facing up to that truth and what it means for your life and what it means for your values and your priorities. I guess finally I'd like to say that what's been missing from this? The system that we're in rewards the wrong things, I think. The economic system that we're in is an extractive model. It's about extracting resources from the natural world and turning them into profit-making. And it's a non-sustainable model. We have been consistently exceeding the world's natural resources year by year, every year since 1971. And the point in the year where our collective activities exceed the natural resources that are available to us in that given year keeps shifting further and further back. So, you know, it used to be November and now it's, if you calculate it year by year, it used to be November and now it's, I think, June, July? You know, halfway through the year when we've already started to exceed our world's natural resources. If we were going to, you know, if you're counting this as if we were living sustainably. So our economic system rewards looting. It rewards short-term gain over long-term gain. And our economic system also rewards, I think, predation of people on other people. It rewards exploitation. Mm. So it's rewarding things that we don't actually value. Hardly anyone actually considers that to be a core value, that they think it's right and good that we should exploit others. You know, that they think that that's something that we should aim for. It's generally, you know, right, left, right wing, left wing. Nobody really thinks that that is nice or worth aiming for. So, yeah, it rewards looting. It rewards predation instead of, I would say, sustainability and cooperation. Our political system rewards short-term gain as well, because everything's on the three or four-year political cycle. So it's this ecological crisis is really, really highlighting some of the major problems in our economic and political systems. And in our ways of thinking about the way we live, the way we treat each other, and the way we interact with our environment. Even the fact that I can say the way we interact with our environment, I think there's a language issue there that comes to a really fundamental heart of the problem. We think we are distinguishable from our environment, and we are not. We are a product of it. We are part of it, and it sustains us. And if we don't take care of it, it won't sustain us anymore.
Holly Champion is a member of Extinction Rebellion. Holly, thanks for coming by.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Custodians of the Planet is an independent and freely available media program and relies entirely on contributions from listeners. If you appreciate what we do and would like to support us, there are a few ways to do so. Start a conversation with your friends and colleagues and be part of the change. Share a link to our podcasts on social media. Donate to our podcast. Each episode is the product of hours of on-location audio recording, editing, research, scheduling, and music composition. Just $10, a couple of coffees will sustain the hours of labor that goes into producing each episode and ensure Custodians of the Planet is an ongoing series. Thank you for your support. I'd like to say special thanks to Rachel Raymond for editing the script, and Chris Jaffordes for his technical support. The song is Choir with Patti Smith singing People Have the Power in New York. I'm Denise Elders. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode. People have the power.